Each time a party went out, they came upon pressure, and occasionally a demonstration of power the like of which they had never witnessed before. On July the 26th, Greenstreet went with Wilde's team for a short run. Seeing some working ice, they paused to watch. As they stood looking, a solid blue-green floe, 9 feet thick, was driven against a neighbouring floe, and together they rose as easily as if they'd been two pieces of cork. When he got back to the ship, Greenstreet wrote in his diary, "Lucky for us if we don't get any pressure like that against the ship, for I doubt whether any ship could stand a pressure that will force blocks like that up." Among the other men, too, the feeling of security was rapidly disappearing. After supper that night, there was a somber quiet in the Ritz. The whole party had been cheered by the sun's refracted image appearing over the horizon for 1 minute just after noon. It was the first time they'd seen it in 79 days. But it did not quite offset the general uneasiness. McNeish, who was never one to dodge the issue, came straight to the point in his diary that night.
"That, the sun, means a lot to us now, as we'll have more daylight as we go along. We're looking for higher temperatures now, but we don't want this floe to break up until there's some open water, for it would mean the ship being crushed if we got adrift at present."
6 days later, at 10 a.m. on August the 1st, while the dog drivers were shoveling snow away from the kennels, there was a tremble, followed by a scraping, grinding sound, and the Endurance rose suddenly upward, then heeled to port and dropped back into the water again, rolling slightly. The floe had broken, and the ship was free. Shackleton was on deck immediately, followed by the rest of the crew. Swiftly he saw what was happening, and he shouted to get the dogs on board. All hands dropped onto the shuddering floe alongside the ship, and went among the dogs, wrenching their chains out of the ice and hurrying them up the gangway. The entire operation took only 8 minutes. It was just in time. As the gangway was being hoisted, the ship moved violently forward and sideways, propelled by the force of the ice driving in and under her. The stout old floe that had protected her so long became an attacker, battering her sides and churning the little dogloos to bits against her. The worst of the pressure was toward the bow, and all hands watched in helpless anxiety as the floes below broke into fragments, reared up, and were overlapped by other fragments, which smashed into the green heart sheathing along the waterline. It went on for 15 agonizing minutes, and then, driven from astern once more, the Endurance's bow slowly climbed up onto a floe ahead. The men could feel her rise, and a spontaneous shout of relief went up. For the moment, she was safe. The ice near the ship remained under intense pressure until shortly after noon, and then settled down. The Endurance remained perched atop the ice with a 5-degree list to port. The boats were cleared for lowering, and all hands were instructed to have their warmest clothing handy in case they should have to get out and walk. But all remained quiet throughout the afternoon and into the evening. Worsley, after recording the day's events, concluded the entry in his diary that evening. "If anything held the ship from rising to such pressure, she would crush up like an empty eggshell. The behaviour of the dogs was splendid. They seemed to regard it as an entertainment we had got up for their benefit." During the night, the wind picked up from the southwest, and by morning it was blowing a gale. These winds, compressing the pack ahead of them, had been responsible for the pressure. By morning, the chunks of ice around the ship had refrozen into a solid mass. Curiously, in the general breakup, one large section of the old floe had come through intact, but it had been driven in against the ship and tilted up at a 45-degree angle so that the well-worn sledge tracks in its surface were now running uphill. Most of the men were put to the task of building new kennels on deck for the dogs. The job required several days' work, and amazingly, even before it was finished, the memory of what had happened was beginning to fade. On August the 4th, just 3 days after the breakup, Shackleton came upon a group of men in the Ritz, speculating confidently that the Endurance was equal to any pressure. He sat down at the table with them. Shackleton said, "There was once a mouse who lived in a tavern. One night, the mouse found a leaky barrel of beer, and he drank all he could hold. When the Mouse had finished, he sat up, twirled his whiskers, and looked around arrogantly.
"Now then," he said, "where's that damned cat?"
In spite of Shackleton's meaningful parable, the growing confidence among the men refused to be stifled. They knew now what pressure was like. They'd seen the ship come through it, and she was none the worse for having done so. The returning sun also did much to raise their spirits. There was now actual daylight for about 3 hours every day, plus 7 or 8 hours of twilight. The men resumed their hockey games on the ice, and some spirited contests were held. When oversized Tom Crean harnessed up the puppies for their first attempt at sledging practice, his efforts stimulated great interest. Worsley observed, "Partly persuaded, mainly driven, they pursue a devious and uncertain course, even more erratic than the poor ships across the Weddell Sea." Again, in an entry for August 15th, Worsley reflected the general high spirits among them. In describing the intense rivalries among the dog team drivers, or owners, Worsley related with a characteristic touch of exaggeration. "Some very tall bragging is indulged in by some in respect to their team's merits and performance. One team appears to suffer from heart disease, their owner evidently expecting the whole creation to hold their breath as they pass by. A vulgar person who often indulges in whoops and yells of "Yoicks, tally-ho," had the indescribable effrontery to let go his horrid war cry whilst riding on the imposing conveyance drawn by these dignified but nervous creatures, and was reproved by their indignant owner, pointing out to the vulgar person into what terror his voice had thrown the beautiful but highly strung and delicate doggies. It is my painful duty to relate that this awful vulgar person, the very next day, being out with an ordinary team, gave vent to his fearsome bellow when passing the heart disease team. The result was disastrous. Two of the poor creatures fainted and had to be brought round with hartshorn, etc., while the remainder went into hysterics until the vulgar person and his associates disappeared over the horizon. The heart disease team belonged to Macklin, who believed in treating his dogs as gently as possible. The awful vulgar person was Worsley himself. Another factor contributing to the general cheerfulness of the party was their drift. Ever since the blizzard in July, they'd been blessed much of the time with strong southerly winds, and during that period they had covered a distance of more than 160 miles. But just at midnight on August the 29th, a single heavy shock struck the ship. A moment later, there was a sound like a distant clap of thunder. The men sat up in their bunks, waiting for something more to happen. But nothing did. The next morning, they saw a thin crack running out astern, but that was all. The rest of the day passed uneventfully. Then, about 6:30 p.m., just as the crew was finishing supper, the Endurance shuddered to the blow of a second shock. Several men jumped up from the table and rushed on deck. Again, there was nothing, except that the crack astern had widened to a mere half inch. The 31st was quiet until about 10 o'clock in the evening. Then the Endurance began to creak and groan like a haunted house. The night watchman reported that the ice ahead and along the port side was on the move, but there was nothing the men could do, so they turned in. But a series of loud snapping noises, which reverberated throughout the ship, kept them awake most of the night. Those whose bunks were on the port side suffered the most. As they lay trying to sleep, they could hear the ice scraping and battering against the hull outside, less than 3 feet from their ears. The noise stopped just before dawn, but it was a tired, jittery group of men who sat down to breakfast that next morning. The pressure began again late in the afternoon, and continued into the evening. That night it was the worst it had been. Worsley described it in his diary. Just after midnight, there was a series of loud and violent cracks, groans, and bumps to the ship, making her jump and shake fore and aft. Many dressed hastily and rushed on deck. Personally, I've got tired of alarms against which we can do absolutely nothing. So when the loudest crash came, I listened to make sure that no ripping, tearing sound of smashing timbers was indicating an entrance of the ice into the hold, then turned over and went to sleep. By the next afternoon, the pressure had ceased, and the Endurance had survived her second attack. Chapter 7 The confidence of the men in their ship should have improved. As Greenstreet recorded in his diary on September the 1st, "She is stronger than we thought, and providing we don't get much heavier pressure, we should pull through all right." But there was no real ring of confidence in Greenstreet's words. Who could say that there wouldn't be heavier pressure? It was not that they doubted the staunchness of the Endurance, but they were acutely aware that she had not been designed to encounter real pressure, much less the fearful pressures of the Weddell Sea, unquestionably the worst on Earth. Furthermore, the three-day attack on the ship had left them all tired and on edge. They had no idea what the future might bring. The novelty was past, and so too was their optimism. The pack was not yet through with them, and they knew it. But all they could do was to wait in helpless, frustrating uncertainty, living through the passage of each day as the drift of the ice carried them north in its own good time, and hoping every day that the Endurance would encounter nothing worse than what she had already endured. Even Worsley, whose spirits rarely flagged, reflected the general anxiety in his diary. "Many of the tabular bergs appear like huge warehouses and grain elevators, but more look like creations of some brilliant architect when suffering from delirium, induced by gazing too long on this damned infernal stationary pack that seems doomed to drift to and fro till the crack of doom splits and shivers it, north, south, east, and west, into 1,000,000,000 fragments, and the smaller the better. No animal life observed. No land. No nothing." They felt most keenly the absence of seals, which would have provided both the pleasures of the chase and the opportunity to taste some fresh meat, a treat they'd not had for 5 months. Still, there were occasional signs that the Antarctic spring was coming. The sun now shone for nearly 10 hours every day, and on September the 10th, the temperature climbed to 1.9 degrees above zero, the highest reading for 7 months. To the men, it seemed like a heat wave. They could go aloft with bare heads and hands in reasonable comfort. A week later, Bobby Clark's biological dredge brought up evidence that the amount of plankton in the water was increasing, a definite sign of the approach of spring. In the Antarctic, plankton, tiny one-celled plants and animals, is the basis for all life. The smallest fishes subsist on it, and they in turn become the food of larger fish, which are eaten by squids and seals and penguins, who constitute the food for killer whales, sea leopards, and giant sperm whales. The cycle of life begins with plankton, and when it is present, the other creatures of the Antarctic are never far behind. 5 days after Clark's report, Jock Wordy sighted an emperor penguin and enticed it out of a patch of open water. It was speedily killed. The following day, a female seal was slain. But in spite of these encouraging signs, an unmistakable air of apprehension was spreading. October the 1st was getting close. Twice before, in August and September, the first of the month had been the signal for severe pressure, and the men had grown superstitious about it. This time, the fates miscalculated by 1 day. The pressure started on September the 30th. About 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Altogether, it lasted only 1 terrifying hour. The attacker this time, a floe off the port bow, bore in mercilessly beneath the foremast. The decks below shuddered and jumped, and the uprights buckled. Chippy McNeish was down in the Ritz, the giant beams over his head bent like a piece of cane. Greenstreet on deck was unable to take his eyes off the foremast, which looked as if it were coming out of her with the tremendous jerks it gave. Worsley was aft by the wheel, and when the pressure was past, he wrote in his diary, "She shows almost inconceivable strength. Every moment it seems as though the flow must crush her like a nutshell. All hands are watching and standing by, but to our relief, just as it appears she can't stand no more, the huge flow, weighing possibly 1,000,000 tons or more, yields to our little ship by cracking across, quarter of a mile, and so relieves the pressure. The behaviour of our ship in the ice has been magnificent. Undoubtedly, she is the finest little wooden vessel ever built." When it was all over, the crew went below to find that many of the decks were permanently buckled, and all manner of articles had been shaken off the shelves, but the ship was still under them.